Welcome to the Weekly Squeak, your weekly geeky squeak with me, Christian Schiller. This week I have an interview with Raj Dutt of Grafana, a very well-known open source project that helps you visualize, log your event data, your log data, your time series data, all sorts of data in nice visual dashboards. But first, here are my links for the week. First, a link on ZDNet from Catalin Kimpanu on a Google Chrome experiment that crashed tabs in, well, probably millions, maybe at least hundreds of thousands of instances. You may not have noticed this because this was very specific to people running Google Chrome in Windows Terminal services, but this is actually a very common setup for Windows users in enterprise companies, which is a lot of people. And the result of this failed experiment was that suddenly lots of tabs went blank, a kind of white screen of death, as it were, and it froze the browser. There were steps to get around it, but of course no one really knew what was going on. Calls to company tech support didn't really know what to do either. And then finally Google admitted that they had enabled an experiment, which happens more often than you may think, actually, which was not working very well on Windows Terminal services, causing these terrible crashes and actually in many cases destroying work, forcing people to restart work they hadn't saved and or wasn't possible to save and things like that. I suppose the reason I want to talk about this is this is not the first time that we've discussed something like this, where a lot of big tech companies will have what's called feature flags to enable and disable and experiment with experiments. And it's relatively easy for them to do that without sending you builds out these days, especially something as a browser where there's various components that can be kind of live updated. And this is good and bad because you can keep things up to date, but that's the other bad. You can keep things up to date and change things without people really knowing they have been changed. Whereas a big sort of whiz-bang release, people at least know it's being updated. They may not actually check what has changed in a changelog and things like that, but especially in an enterprise environment where typically administrators will roll out software changes, they at least will check before rolling it out. But in this case, it bypassed those administrators who were also unable to do anything about it. So I guess it's a lesson to developers to bear in mind that they are not the be-all and end-all, and that sometimes checks and balances are in place or barriers for constantly updating things are in place for a reason, and that sometimes just enabling or disabling a harmless flag or feature can have way more unintended consequences than you may realize. Now, if you've had enough of Google Chrome, but you haven't had enough of Chromium, which is what Google Chrome is built on top of and allows us to use so many of these wonderful extensions, there are actually many options. Google Chrome is just one option. I don't have Google Chrome anymore. I have not had it installed on my computer for probably at least 6 months. Opera is based on Chromium. Microsoft Edge is based on Chromium. Chromium is based on Chromium, but also Brave. I've been trying to get an interview with someone on the Brave team for a while, and they somewhat vanished off the communication thread, but I will keep trying. Brave is made by Brave. I use it. I firstly started using it because I've been doing a lot of work in the crypto space, and it's popular in that space because it has an inbuilt wallet. It has the attention token, which is quite fascinating. It sort of lets you collect tokens for watching certain ads, and then you can reassign those tokens to people who are signed up for the program and sort of make micropayments to content creators, and it works quite well. But even ignoring that, I quite like it because it's privacy-focused, it's Chromium, so you get access to extensions, and it's open source. So for me, I used to like Opera for similar reasons, but it wasn't open source, and I wanted to try Firefox, but then I don't get access to the extensions. So it's a nice sort of mid-ground to match all those requirements I had. It recently went into to version 1 out of beta, I guess. And this article was specifically on the Crypto Globe from Francisco Memoria, but this was covered in a few places, that since it went into version 1, its usage, or at least search results about it, have soared. it is experiencing quite an upspike, maybe for some of the reasons I have already mentioned. There are still a couple of controversies around Brave, mostly to do with its founder, who has a checkered past, shall we say, to say the least. But it is quite a nice product, actually. I'm quite happy with it. I've had a few bugs somewhat relating to the last story, but generally they are fixed quite quickly. And it's available cross-platform, of course, and you get access to Chromium extensions with privacy-focused features that sometimes break websites, but you can enable and disable. And the whole BAT, the basic attention token, or Brave attention token, I can't quite remember, is a nice idea. Whether it will actually amount to very much in the long run remains to be seen, but it's a nice idea. So go and check it out. The next article is from Fast Company, from Cliff Quang, called Apple Built a $1 Trillion Empire on Two Metaphors. One is Breaking. This is an article that somewhat mixes computing history with computing present to talk specifically about how certain ideas can make or break a company, but there comes a point when the company maybe has to recognize that those ideas are starting to run out of steam, which is what the writer is claiming in this article. And in this particular case, the writer argues that Apple's three main innovations have been the Macintosh OS, whether we all can claim that it was their invention is a whole other story. The iPod click wheel, which is an interesting one. He argues that this was the first interface, physical at the time, that allowed people to scroll through long lists, in this particular case of music, of course, or audio files, of course. It seems such a long time ago, I can't even really remember how revolutionary or not it was, but anyway. And then the iPhone touchscreen, again, not new, but we know that Apple is somewhat synonymous with perfecting, in quote marks, ideas rather than creating. He then goes into some detail about talking about how other companies have had similar fates. Amazon basically revolutionized shopping with the one-click mechanism, which they then licensed to many other companies, Apple included. And then the article kind of goes deeper into breaking down some of the user interface decisions that Apple have made, from skeuomorphism, which is sort of largely now a bit defunct and a bit dated, to sort of flat design, I guess, designs to meet the modern paradigm, which have happened more recently. And to be honest with you, whilst the article, I think it's an excerpt from a book, which possibly explains the style as sometimes feeling a little bit sort of philosophical with no real conclusions, it's interesting to read nonetheless, despite that sounding like a bit of maybe a negative statement. I found it quite interesting to read, but it's more sort of thoughts around the topics than any concrete outcomes. And the article, and it is definitely an excerpt, concludes with the thought of that maybe because we tried to force paradigms into one another, like the App Store is one that he kind of quotes here, we've ended up with something that is a bit broken now because they have reached their natural conclusion. And he proposes the idea of new paradigms, new metaphors. And this one he proposes is about relationships. We care about, instead of opening an app, we remain connected with people. Now, this is interesting because as far as I remember, this is actually what Windows Phone tried to do and somewhat failed. So was it that Windows Phone was too early? Was it that no one actually cares? How do you connect a relationship with someone to playing a game of Flappy Bird? What's that got to do with a relationship? For example, going on Instagram to broadcast, is that a relationship with somebody? Not really. I guess the argument could be that we'd all be better off if we were doing that instead of Flappy Bird and Instagram, but I'm not 100% sure if that's what people want. So, yeah, it's an interesting statement. It is from the book User-Friendly, How the Hidden Rules of Design Are Changing the Way We Live, Work, and Play. So I'm guessing you have to read on to find out more. Maybe I will try and get the author on for an interview in the future. But in the meantime, have a read of this excerpt and let me know what you think. You can let me know your thoughts on anything you've heard in the show by finding the contact details at christianchiller.com/contact. Next, in my regular SoftBank watch, I'm determined to be claimed as the person who first realized that We were worrying about the wrong companies, and we should have been worried about SoftBank all along. This is an article specifically from mobileworldlive.com by Manny Pham. And this is about how SoftBank and Line are forming a $30 billion company. Line are kind of like Facebook Messenger, plus some other things. Also Pay, based mostly in Korea and Japan. You may not have used them in Europe or America, but they are quite a big deal in Asia. And SoftBank, we already know, investors behind Uber, behind WeWork, behind many other companies, actually. And the title, the headline is slightly misleading. This is actually a merge between a SoftBank subsidiary, Zed Holdings, which is actually formerly Yahoo Japan. So this gets more and more interesting, is merging with Line. Primarily, I think, for this Japanese-Korean company to try and compete with US and Chinese tech companies, feeling the pressure from both sides, I guess. And then it doesn't really go into any more detail about what this is going to mean, but it may also surprise you to know that Line has 82 million users in Japan, so it's pretty big, but Yahoo still has over 50 million active users in Japan. So it's bigger than you may think. So I guess this brings together quite a large cohort of people. Getting out of news, maybe into more kind of interesting thoughts on things. Next is an article from Wired by Alex Christian. And I like articles like this. I've covered ones with SimCity in the past. What if the Soviet Union never collapsed? Meet the Football Manager fans rewriting history. This is an article about Mladen Barbaric. I'm guessing he's from the Balkan world, maybe Serbo-Croatian world, so I made an attempt to pronounce his surname correctly, has been working through a game called Football Manager. I vaguely remember this game, I think, if it's the one I'm thinking of, where you can kind of build simulations and things and let them run. And he has actually created a whole world where it's still, the USSR still exists. The opening paragraph kind of says it. I will quote it here. The year is 3019. The mighty Brentford FC have won the Premier League for the second year in a row. The Berlin Wall still stands, and Yugoslavia is a hotbed of world football. Leicestershire, meanwhile, has declared its independence from England to become a tax haven, leading to unprecedented success for Leicester City. And this is basically what this guy has created. He's a Formula journalist, and he's tweaked the database of Football Manager to include an EU-style Soviet Union, where sides can only sign three foreign players, but mostly from within the Iron Curtain, but also many other. In fact, he made 100,000 changes, which is somewhat crazy. And some of the outcomes of this, I'm not entirely sure if it's what he added, simulated this, or how the game has ended up running. I don't entirely know how a Football Manager game does this, has created some quite fascinating geopolitical schisms and changes that you wouldn't expect to be quite so closely tied to football. I guess there's more to football than maybe I thought. And he also added lots of badges for defunct Eastern European clubs. He had a lot of time on his hands, maybe, but it's really fascinating. I don't know if you can see it playing out anywhere. Maybe you can if you download the game. But still, if you would like to know about alternative futures, but through the lens of football, then go and have a read of the article. And finally, on the game front, this is from Ars Technica, from Dan Thoreau. I think I have quoted his column many times when it comes to board games, about Tapestry. The mythical two-hour civ-building game. Has it arrived? This is from Jamie Stegmeyer's Tapestry. I have been offered to play this game with some friends, but it didn't quite work out, but I still would really like to. Civ games, i.e. games where you build a civilization from scratch and build it up, tend to take a long time, even board games. Anything from 2 hours up to something like Mega Civ, which can take all day and is extremely large and extremely in-depth. But he claimed to have invented a two-hour Civ game, and this game has been divisive for many reasons. Firstly, some of their tactics for marketing and reviewing the game have been controversial and split the community. But also because to fit a Civ game into 2 hours, it actually abstracts a lot. And this has not necessarily been a popular choice. There's always a decision with game design about what you abstract. But perhaps one of the things people like about Civ games is the minutiae. Granted, I think there are actually other Civ games that kind of do this. Roll Through the Ages, for example. And others, Seven Wonders, for example, is building a civilization but abstracted quite a lot. But I suppose the nature and the look of the game was that it looked more like a more traditional Civ game, and it isn't necessarily. So a lot of it's abstracted. And this has caused some division in the board gaming community. And the board gaming community is nothing but opinionated, much like many geek communities. So have you played the game? I haven't yet. What did you think? Are you a one-star reviewer? Are you a five-star reviewer? This seems to be the current range of opinions on the game. Again, if you have something to tell me, then head over to chrischiller.com/contact and let me know. I hope you enjoyed my links for the week. And now here is an interview I did with Raj Dutt of Grafana. Enjoy.
So my name is Raj Dutt. I'm one of the co-founders and the CEO of Grafana Labs. We're the company behind the Grafana open source project and a whole lot more.
And I've heard of Grafana. I've actually used it a little bit in the past, not so much recently, but I might actually have an excuse to use it again soonish.
Hope so.
What is, for the people who don't know, what is Grafana?
So Grafana is basically visualization and analytics software, open source, works with many, many, many different databases. So we're not a database vendor. We work, we're neutral. We work with a lot of different database vendors, but Grafana connects to wherever your data is, right? Wherever it's, whether it's in the cloud, on-prem, and it helps you understand and kind of unify all your data beautifully. Open source software was created by our co-founder, Torkel Odegaard in Sweden, about 6 years ago. And hundreds of thousands of developers and users around the world use Grafana every day.
And what would that, I'm guessing then, I mean, I'm asking a slightly leading question here because I know what it looks like, but is that the ability to then render that into dashboards, charts, tables, et cetera, et cetera?
Yep. I mean, you know, the human brain is actually really awesome at pattern matching visually based on your data. So that's what Grafana is all about, right? Is we render charts, graphs, all sorts of visualizations, help you build dashboards so you can kind of, you know, build the perfect, picture that helps you understand your system, whatever it is, right? And it's not just DevOps or, you know, servers or infrastructure, you know, IT stuff. People use Grafana for all sorts of things, like, emergency rooms in Tokyo use it to monitor the wait times of different ERs across the city. You know, there's a lot of people using it even for industrial process control and sensor data stuff, right? So, but to answer your question, Chris, yeah, it's all about graphs, visualizations, dashboards, those sort of things.
So to understand how Grafana sits into comparison with other visualization and analysis projects and products, you mentioned it connects to databases. So is it live data, or is it usually like post-event data, or both? Or, you know, how do people connect to it?
Yeah, great question. It's generally live data, right? So the cool thing about Grafana is, and Grafana Labs, in my opinion, I'm biased, of course, right? But is we're not a database vendor, right? So a lot of other visualization tools or monitoring tools or just, software that does, analysis tends to be tied to a particular, database or technology. And that's because the visualization tool is actually created by a database vendor, right? So, it's sort of like, well, great visualization tool works with my, this one database. And we think it's kind of a broken model. I mean, the whole world it's like the oldest lie in IT, right? The single pane of glass. And everyone is pitching, providing a single pane of glass. But everyone's pitch is dependent on all your data going into this one database in order to give you the single pane of glass. And we think that that's just disingenuous, right? And it's never going to happen. And let's just stop trying to lie to ourselves, basically.
I think I have a vague idea of what databases you're referring to, but and maybe we'll touch upon one of them in a minute. Because when you say you connect to databases, this isn't necessarily databases that people might use for more the sort of the logic back end of their applications, like Postgres or something like that. Is it you're talking about kind of logging databases or?
It's another great question, Chris. So yeah, like logging databases or metrics databases would be the most common within Grafana. So, for example, things like Prometheus or Graphite or, you know, InfluxDB would be really popular metrics databases within our community, right? So, you know, for monitoring. And then you're absolutely right. Logging databases, maybe databases is a broad word in the way we're using it, but logging databases like, say, Elasticsearch or Splunk.
Yeah.
You know, and, but then, you know, regarding, you know, application logic and things like this, sort of over the last year or two, Grafana has added support for SQL. Okay. So sort of your more traditional databases, including Postgres, MySQL, MSSQL, you know, databases that traditionally aren't used for kind of IT operational data, right? Like it's not really, your logs generally aren't stored in SQL databases normally. They sometimes are, you know, your metrics, you know, sometimes will be stored in SQL. But this is sort of broadening the use case of Grafana to include sort of business metrics, you know, sensor data. You know, a lot of people want to put some, maybe some application data that is stored in SQL right alongside some infrastructure data or logging data. You know, that's useful to show context, right? Like you're probably not, you know, that data may not all live in your log. So Grafana is all about recognizing that, you know, your data is really spread out all over the place and it's valuable to bring it together in a single dashboard or even a single panel so you can kind of correlate it and give it better context, right? You know, like, I mean, you know, maybe you're, you know, maybe there's stats coming off from the marketing team that lives in, you know, some other SaaS vendor or, you know, even a Google Sheets database. I mean, you know, database. You know, those are Grafana is all about unifying data no matter where it lives. And most Grafana users have some primary databases, like what you mentioned, so for say logging or metrics. But then, you know, especially the larger ones, they've got another team that's using, you know, that's made a different choice for their logging database or their different choice for their metrics database, or they've gone and signed a contract with a vendor like Datadog or Splunk. And then yet another team has set up an app that's, you know, putting logs in SQL. And then, you know, at some point, what do you do, right? You can say, hey, everyone, let's all use the same thing. But for most organizations, they're going to have this sort of, you know, heterogeneous complexity. You know what I mean?
Actually, this is something that interests me quite a lot because you're right about context, that, you know, there's a lot of applications now, especially in this more modern application design around microservices. And I know you've been at KubeCon this week. I was at the one in Europe earlier this year. I was also just at having a complete blank. Where was I? I was at la 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 la. I don't know.
I was at, it's all blurring together for me too.
I had a conference up in Berlin where Grafana were there quite recently.
Oh, probably PromCon.
No?
Nope? Okay. To be honest, Chris, I'm losing track of our developers are so bad.
I don't know where I was. I was somewhere where you were there and it was very relevant and I can't for the life of me remember it was. But anyway,
right.
Yeah, this sort of aspect of having multiple parts of an application now returning data in all sorts of different formats, some of it in more standard, some of it in less standard. And trying to get context from all that is quite difficult. So
yep.
I wonder with a project like Grafana, how much sort of massaging and handholding do you do to help that happen? Or is there still a lot of configuration on the implementer's side? Or is it the classic answer of it depends?
It's a little bit of the classic answer of it depends, yeah. I suppose. But, you know, what Grafana tries to do is we try to We don't try to sort of abstract the different databases we connect to, you know, provide like a lowest common denominator or something like that, right? There's actually some features coming in a future version of Grafana that allow you to do that. Like, so you don't, you know, you kind of have one, almost call it like one low level query language to, you know, rule all the databases, yeah. Which is kind of interesting. But right now, and, you know, which has its trade-offs, you know, it's both positive and negative. I mean, but right now we provide the full power of every database or data source that we connect to Grafana users, meaning we expose the full capabilities of the query language or API, right? So if you're connecting to, you know, Elasticsearch, you actually get the full, you know, sort of Lucene query language that, you know, Elasticsearch provides, right? If you're connecting to, you know, Prometheus, you get PromQL, right? You interface natively within Prometheus. And Grafana tries to make it really easy to do so. And what I mean by that is, you know, we go and build, you know, these query editors and point and click kind of, you know, query builders for all these different data sources so that we make it as easy as possible for, you know, for the users to interact with those databases. So in a lot of ways, we're actually trying to, like, along with unifying the databases and the data for context, we want to ideally make, you know, in many cases we're able to do this, but our goal is always to kind of make a point and click experience almost for the underlying data, the particular database that you know you're interacting with. And there's something like 42 databases available that Grafana supports today. Mm-hmm. But if you shouldn't have to be a developer, right? Like, yeah. Ideally, you should. If you have the context of the data, and let's say you're a marketing person, and you know all about your sessions and your clicks and your conversions and your goals and everything like that, you should be able to not just consume a dashboard that someone's put together for you. You should be able to create your own dashboard, and you should be able to, you know, be able to analyze your data without having to go talk to a developer and say, I want to get this view of things, which
the old job of like in the days gone by, it was like the CRM teams. You know,
right.
I would like to know about the users we had last week, and then 2 weeks later, you get it back, and
exactly.
By which point, it's all a bit too late. You know,
right. What was the question again? Like, oh, wrong question.
Not really how businesses work anymore. A lot, not all, but
sure. Well, you'd be surprised.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Actually, but, yeah. I've actually had pleasant experiences recently where I've spoken about microservices and the sort of the streaming data pipelines with companies you wouldn't expect to be doing it, and they're quite fully on board, and thus helping other enterprises you consider a bit outdated to realize it's beneficial to them. So, you know, you get evangelists and then it spreads and people start to realize the benefits. So, yeah, anyway. I'm always interested to know, like, what made you or whoever it was who started the project in the first place start it? What itch were you trying to scratch?
Well, I mean, I definitely can't take credit for starting the project, right? I mean, our co-founder, Torkel, started it before the company existed. And, you know, the story, it's like, I guess, I suppose, like most open source projects, it's all around scratching your own itch, right? So, you know, back in 2014, early 2014, you know, Torkel is in Sweden doing a lot of consulting for, you know, various tech companies in Sweden, including, say, you know, eBay Sweden and, you know, H&M and, you know, other large companies while he's kind of hanging out in Stockholm. And he just doesn't have the tooling that he wants as a, you know, consultant to kind of show people their performance data. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Graphite was available at the time, but it was really hard to use, right? And Graphite was something, you know, what sort of the original time series open source monitoring database. And it was getting really popular in 2014 and kind of the DevOps monitoring community, you know, still is one of the most popular time series databases, you know, even though it's I suppose less trendy now. But he was using Graphite and sort of really found the UI for Graphite lacking and was, you know, wanted to create something that was sort of both more easy to use, but just looked a lot better, right? Because you want this stuff to, you know, look good and look, you know, beautiful and, you know, because that helps the people who are creating these dashboards look good, right? Because then they look, you know, like heroes. So he really wanted something that worked well with Graphite, was easy to use and looked great. And then he just threw this thing over the wall as an open source personal project, didn't really expect that, you know, a lot of other people would like it. And, you know, I wish he was here to tell you the story himself, but sort of the next day his phone was melting down with kind of retweets and people, you know, liking the project and talking about it. And then it just, you know, went viral essentially because, you know, classic story of, you know, software that really worked well that, you know, solved a very specific need. Right. Mm. And I think the timing was good because that was sort of the beginning of the whole time series data category, if you will. Right. And then, you know, now if whether you're using Influx or Prometheus or, you know, Graphite or Elastic or whatever, I mean, time scale, there's so many now, you know, chances are you're using Grafana, So, yeah.
I think I first encountered Grafana in about 2015. So not, it's relatively new, I suppose.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. It's funny because we still run into people who are running old versions of Grafana. So Tokel's always like, oh my God, you're literally like, you know, you're 3 years old and they're like 4 years old. You know,
I was
like,
mostly just doing it to write tutorial stuff for a client, a database that was like a logging database of some form. So it wasn't. It's not still running, that's for sure. So, and in many ways, the project seems to have followed a very traditional path for open source projects. At a certain point, you added the commercial/enterprise offering on top, which I'm guessing is Grafana Labs. So what's the difference between the open source project and the commercial offerings?
So we have two commercial offerings, you know, basically, Chris. We have Grafana Enterprise, which is, consider it a version of Grafana that has features and integrations that are really oriented at the, you know, our largest users, the largest companies in the world. And that's bundled with, you know, support and indemnification and, you know, SLAs around, you know, critical responses. So it's essentially providing a little bit more and wrapping it up with, you know, support helping people de-risk Grafana, run it at scale, right? That's Grafana Enterprise. And so that's our, you know, that's one of our products. And the other product we have is Grafana Cloud. And Grafana Cloud is, we will run a full observability stack for you, host it for you, manage it for you, scale it for you, includes Grafana, obviously it includes Prometheus for your metrics. It includes Loki for your logs. We'll store everything, just send it all to us. We'll just bill you by, you know, how much data you send us. So it's kind of like a, you know, fully hosted observability platform using completely, you know, open standards and open tooling, right? Like Prometheus and Grafana, Loki. So those are our two products, you know, essentially one's helping you run Grafana on-prem at scale, whatever your databases are. And the other is a full curated stack, you know, complete with metrics, logs, Grafana, soon to be tracing also.
Yep. Okay. And this is a question I have to ask a lot of people in your situation right now. You're not the first I've asked this. How do you manage to compete in contrast to cloud providers who often offering very similar things? Ironically, you're probably running on some of their infrastructure as well.
Sure.
You know, it's been quite controversial in the open source world at the moment where business model for a lot of these companies has somewhat been pulled out from underneath them by the very people who were helping them in the first place.
It's such a weird topic, right? Because, and so, you know, we are obviously customers of some of these vendors because we deploy, you know, our cloud offerings on top of them, you know, and then... there's so many ways to answer that question. Let me just say a few things, I guess. We don't have any plans to, you know, come up with any sort of fake open source licensing, in terms of expensive games, right? We have open source software and that's, you know, provided under OSI approved licenses like Apache. And then we also have commercial software like Grafana Enterprise and parts of Grafana Cloud. And that software is not open source. And we don't want to play these games that like, oh, look at this open code that's here that's not open source, that's under this weird license that, you know, like our open source is open source and our commercial software is commercial and also closed source.
Yeah,
and
so the commercial stuff is only available from you. And I guess you have to offer enough with it that people don't need to go elsewhere.
and you know, the whole going elsewhere thing is really interesting too, because I think a lot of people are disingenuous when they look at it, right? Or they don't have a balanced view. Open source, you know, has always been about value creation, not value capture. And these open source companies are clearly much more about value capture, but they're built on a licensing model that is all about value creation. And they're built on a business model that requires a lot of value creation to happen in order to capture a small amount of value, you know, small amount of it, right? That is the model of open source. And I think a lot of people get kind of really caught up because the simple fact is that the new distribution channel for software is cloud. So if you as an open source vendor can't, you know, be the center of mass for your distribution, then that's a you know, that's a business model problem for you. You know, you can make an argument to someone like AWS that what they're doing is not sustainable. Maybe it's not, you know, morally the best thing. You can make those arguments, but at the same time, AWS is in a, and companies like them, you know, are in a position where they want to commoditize compute for their business, for, you know, for their cloud business. And they do that by running software that their customers want to run. Guess what? The software that their customers want to run is increasingly open source software. Mm. Guess what? Those licenses allow AWS to just run that software. Why wouldn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, yeah. Oh, no, it's, yeah. Anyway, let's, yeah. I've lost my, oh, yes. So, I mean, I'm guessing with your open source model anyway, you don't necessarily know what people are measuring and logging, because that would
somewhat... We don't even know who the people
no,
are.
No, exactly. Exactly. but from
I mean, yeah. I mean we have a rough idea that there's about, you know, 400,000 plus Grafana instances running out there.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We don't really know who's running them, what they're monitoring, what they're doing. We have some very, we have some good ways to get a handle on it, but it's all just,
So from that very little limited worldview you do have, from what people have told you and things like that, I guess what are some of the interesting trends you may have seen through the eyes of their data? What are the sorts of things that people are increasingly monitoring?
I think Kubernetes is way up there, right? So, I mean, particularly because if you're running Kubernetes, you're probably running Prometheus. If you're running Prometheus, you're probably running Grafana kind of thing, right? So there's a really nice tie-in there. And there's a really nice tie-in with our new logging project, Loki, which works really well with Prometheus, right? So we're seeing a really big uptake in Prometheus within kind of the IT use case.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the other thing I'll just talk about real quick is the non-IT use case has gone from 0 to 20% of our community, which means whether it's financial data, weather data, you know, how fast your, you know, wind turbines are spinning, you know, all that kind of stuff is sort of super interesting to us, right? But you know, in with regard to IT stuff, I'd say Kubernetes. We're definitely seeing a big push there. Mm-hmm. Particularly because we're kind of focusing on that with Loki. And then I'd say the other things we're seeing are people using the native cloud data sources that we have. So we provide we connect to things like CloudWatch or Google Stackdriver or Azure Monitor, most cloud vendors provide sort of a metrics and logging platform that all your, all the telemetry from your infrastructure that you're running with the cloud will kind of automatically be there, right? Kind of automatically be on CloudWatch or Stackdriver or whatever. And traditionally, in order to use that data, customers would have to either extract it, from, say, CloudWatch into wherever, right? Or they'd have to go log into CloudWatch to look at it, which both from a, flow standpoint and a usability standpoint wasn't necessarily the best thing, right? So sort of two bad choices. One is sort of realizing that, hey, I have all these CloudWatch metrics and logs that I need to look at sometimes. And they're all kind of provided by, say, AWS for free because I'm running my stuff on AWS. How do I look at that data? Choice number one, I have to pay to extract it all to some provider like a Datadog or something. And then I can all look at it, like look up all my stuff in one place. And I'm going to have to pay for that. I'm going to have to pay AWS to extract it. I'm going to have to pay Datadog to store it. And it's going to be delayed. And, I'm hardly going to look at it, but it's just all there because when I do need to look at it, it can be there, right? Mm-hmm. Or choice B is don't move it from CloudWatch and just log into CloudWatch whenever you want to go look at something. Right.
And this especially helps with the kind of hybrid cloud approach, I guess, when you'll have different sets anyway.
Yeah. And we give a new choice. And I think we're pretty unique in that regard. And this is a use case we're seeing more and more is we say, look, Mr. Customer, choice A and choice B kind of both suck, for lack of a better word. We'll give you choice C, right? Yeah. And choice C is just use Grafana and then connect to CloudWatch. And now all your CloudWatch metrics are available to you in real time whenever you load a dashboard. So now you're just going to pay AWS for a dashboard load occasionally, or you know, whatever alerts you need to run, whatever you know, routinely. But you're probably never going to even look at 90% of your CloudWatch metrics, but you need them there because you don't know what you're going to need to look at when you're going to need to look at them. So there's no cost to just connect CloudWatch, right? So if you go look at a, you know, let's say you've got, I don't know, you know, 10,000 pods at, you know, or containers at AWS, you don't know which 20 you're going to need to look at. So, you know, so you're going to copy all 10,000 and pay to store all 10,000 somewhere else? No, like just connect the CloudWatch data source. And then whenever you have an outage, you'll pull up whatever dashboard you want. And you're probably going to read 2% ever of the data stored in CloudWatch. So why wouldn't you just pay for that? You know, right? So it's kind of like giving the customer choice, like still move it if you want. We'll help you move it into, say, Prometheus, right? But why be forced to think like that, right? And I think the reason customers have been forced to think like that is because generally the monitoring vendors are all database vendors in one shape or form.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. And I guess to keep up with whatever are current or you predict forthcoming trends in the space, what's next on your roadmap for the next 6 months or so?
Well, we're going to one thing that's exciting to us is we're going to kind of complete the observability picture with traces. Right. So Grafana's traditionally been strong on metrics. We've added logs and we've launched Loki. You know, the open source project Loki is going really well. The adoption in the last sort of 11 months while the project's been alive has been, since it's been launched, has been fantastic. So one future thing we're excited about is we're gonna, you know, you can watch for some announcements around the tracing space. You know, we're gonna be providing sort of interoperability with things like Jaeger, you know, so that Grafana, you know, kind of deals with, you know, metrics data, logging data, and tracing data as, you know, three kind of first class sort of citizens of telemetry, if you will. So that kind of completes the picture for us. And then the other thing we're excited about is, you know, we're also going to be kind of, you know, launching a couple of new offerings on our cloud kind of towards the summer that really expand the capabilities sort of beyond, you know, metrics, logs, and tracing into particular kind of use cases and applications. So, you know, watch for some announcements there too.
And that was my interview with Rajdutt of Grafana. I hope you enjoyed that. So a few things coming up from me over the next, well, the remainder of the year, I guess. I am at 5G Checkatree, probably right now as you're listening to this. So if you happen to be in Riga, come say hi. Then I will be going to DevRelCon in London on the 11th and 12th of December. And then that's probably it for the year. And then after that, I might be at CES this year, and I'm definitely going to be at South by Southwest. I might even be in Lagos in February, but that is not defined. All of these are kind of subject to flight bookings and all sorts of things to see what I could afford right now. So I don't have anything massively new to share. I will have a few new articles coming out very soon. You can still find my generative fiction roleplay game on itch.io. One Day the World Ended. Just look that up, or you can find it on my website too. And actually, yes, I do have some news. Chip Shop, the board game I started working on a few years ago, took to Essen, took to a few game fairs, and then somewhat abandoned because I just got overwhelmed. We are back designing. I have a co-designer, Andy, my friend Andy. We complement each other well, and we are back rebuilding the game. So I'll have more news on that soon. And also my second book is, I think, getting to the end of a first draft. I'm hoping to put some time in over Christmas. I'm getting quite pleased with the results, and I'm starting to think about how I'm going to release it. I might actually release it in a collaboratory way, maybe as a Git book or something like that. I feel like that's what I want to do, as opposed to releasing it as an actual book. But we shall see. Keep up to date with me at christianchiller.com. And as always, you can find my contact details, how to support me, previous shows, newsletters, all that good stuff on the same website. And until next time, if you have been, thank you very much for listening.